Commodore's case, what we have is Mr. Ciccolo and Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Ciccolo, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes, please.
Judge Austin, it's Judge Petty. All right. I could also ask the parties to use a handset rather than a speakerphone. It makes it easier to hear.
I am on handset. Is this better?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Ciccolo, you can begin when ready, sir.
Yes. All right, Your Honors, the appeal of Mr. Becerra of the decision by the commission majority is before you because the majority applied an erroneous and ex post facto standard in denying Mr. Becerra's once-in-a-lifetime claim for a permanent injury that has rendered him handicapped for life. This ruling...
This is Judge Austin, and I appreciate your presentation to us to this point, but because we have limited time, let me get into a question that concerns me with regard to this case. It seems that everything that we're considering is going to be resolved by advancement of the principles of either res judicata or collateral estoppel. Let me ask this: was there at any time during the second third presentation of evidence and information, particularly involving Dr. Jackson, where anyone said, "Dr. Jackson, can you tell us what has changed from the evaluation that was done by the prior doctor to this point?" And the reason why I ask that is that if that is indeed the case, and you can point something in the record that shows that there is a change in the substance as far as the change in circumstances of the claimant, would go a long way for me to help resolve your case.
Okay, Your Honor, I'm going to focus the court's attention to page 7 of the reply brief, and I've tried to set a table there that summarizes the physical findings of each of the doctors, and I have the record references to each of their reports. Now, the Dr. Jackson did a very detailed report, and I'd like the court to note that this gentleman has 40 years' experience. He's a professor at the Medical School of Georgetown, former team physician of the Redskins. But going through this table on page 7 of the reply brief, here's what's happened. First, we had a disability rating of 11% of the right lower extremity. Now we have one of 24%. The earlier rating was found to be defective, but by objective measurement standards, we have two physicians that have measured it dramatically different. Secondly, the dates of maximum medical improvement are 2 years apart. Maximum medical improvement, as the court knows, is a required finding for a permanent partial disability award. In one case, we have February 24, 2012. Now we have a totally new date.
This is Judge Petty. Didn't you stipulate MMI at that first hearing?
Yes.
So,
yes, for an injury that was found to lack evidence to support it.
But the claimant had reached maximum medical improvement by that hearing.
For the injury that was addressed and found by the commission to be fatally defective. This case is really no different from Rusty's welding and Brown versus United. In Rusty's, the rating was insufficient because there was no MMI and no explanation. In this case, we have MMI, but the rating was found to be defective. And in Rusty's, this court said that the ruling was not res judicata because it was only based on the evidence available at that time.
In Rusty's, didn't the commission specifically note that it wasn't making a ruling, quote, at this time? Wasn't that the language that we kind of fixated upon to determine that it wasn't res judicata?
Yes, but those words, premature and at this time, that were used in Rusty's, were referred to in Brown's versus United Airlines as a distinction without a difference, that if you have a premature claim and there's no finding that warns the other side of finality, it is not binding. And in this case, what we have is a ruling that reverses but does not dismiss, a finding. And on two occasions, Your Honor, the full commission interpreted this ruling as not being final. One of those rulings was made in this very case. And direct the court to page 176 of the appendix. This was a subsequent application where asked the court to rely upon the 11% rating that it's found to be deficient to at least preserve jurisdiction of the claim until we...
Counsel, if we could work our way back a little bit, it seems, looking at the record, that there was a clear disagreement in evaluation between Dr. Salter and Dr. Jackson, and reasonable mind can differ, and I'm sure that that's true in the medical profession also. But what did Dr. Jackson say in the course of his evaluation that said something different had occurred from the time that Dr. Salter gave his made his evaluation?
Well, going through the chart on page 7, we didn't get through them all. For example, no left motor extremity weakness or sensory deficits. That was the finding of Dr. Salter. Dr. Jackson found objective and subjective weakness of left calf musculature and great difficulty completing 20 repetitive toe rises.
But one could argue that that's simply a difference of opinion. I guess maybe I'm not asking the question very well. The thing that I'm driving at is there anything in the record where Dr. Jackson says, since Dr. Salter evaluated Mr. Papura, this has indeed occurred, as opposed to saying, I'm comparing what Dr. Salter says, and I am disagreeing with it?
Well, he didn't specifically state that, he did specifically state that Dr. Salter did not do the toe test. But if you look at the straight leg raising, that had deteriorated. Straight leg raising was uncomfortable, but with no limitations for Dr. Salter. Dr. Jackson finds straight leg raising that has discomfort at 70 degrees on the left and beyond 90 degrees on the right. That's a materially different finding. With the lateral bending, we have a more severe limitation. We had 25 to 30 degrees with Dr. Salter. Now it's down to 20 degrees. There was no radiating leg pain. That was the basis for the commission to find that the 11% award was defective. Dr. Jackson found unresolved radiculopathy of the left lower extremity. So these are all materially different findings. And then finally, Dr. Salter found no left lower extremity motor weakness or sensory deficits. Dr. Jackson found just the opposite. Now, these were all swept under the rug. Now, the commission that renders a published opinion, in fact, they rendered two, where they say the claimant must provide some evidence of permanent partial disability within 36 months from the date for which compensation was last paid, reading from page 176 of the record, and that the our request for retaining jurisdiction was dismissed without prejudice. That they weren't going to retain jurisdiction because if we filed by March 29, 2014, our claim could be considered. Now, if the claim's res judicata, why on earth would you publish an opinion of that nature? The commission is not in the business of rendering sinister traps for claimants. Indeed, the act's supposed to be liberally construed. But we go one better. In the Dolgen Corp case, the commission cites this case, and this was in March of last year. And in citing the case, the full commission says that Bucera's claim was dismissed without prejudice, and I'm quoting, "We dismiss the claim without prejudice with the right to refile within the statutory period." This ruling is not only at odds with what the commission has said in two published opinions, it's at odds with what this court has held in Rusty's and in Brown. And the first rule is of res judicata. It's the burden of proof of the party asserting it. The commission turned it on its head and put the claimant, the burden exclusively on the claimant. Two, is the evidence the same or different? The evidence in this case is going to be different for what was presented in 2012 than in 2014. The same evidence is not going to support
Mr. Trickler,
each
this
claim.
This is Judge Petty. As I'm looking at this, it seemed to me that in that first hearing, you were requesting permanent partial, and you had the burden of establishing that, and the commission found that you did not. That was a final ruling that was not appealed, basically holding claimant did not have any permanent partial disability. And then you come back at a later date, and it seems to me to be the same injury, and now you want to relitigate that. And I don't understand why res judicata doesn't prevent that.
Because it's basically what this court held in Browns and Rusty's.
In Browns and Rusty's, we were talking about whether or not the claimant had reached MMI, which is something that is not final until it's final. I mean, you can come in and request and say, okay, commission finds he hasn't reached MMI, so we'll defer to a later date when he has. But this is an issue of whether there was any disability in the first instance.
What is the difference between a rating that doesn't have MMI, which was what you had in Rusty's and Brown, versus a case where you have no permanency rating but MMI? You need both for the disability rating. This claim has never been adjudicated. And the fact that the commission did not intend it to be a final ruling is evidenced by three facts. One, it didn't dismiss. It reversed without dismissal. Two, it said it wasn't a final ruling and told the claimant to refile. And it did that twice, Your Honor. And when we followed it, when we did what the commission said, we found out they didn't really mean what they said. They didn't really mean what they said because it was, oh, we didn't really mean that. We only meant you could file for additional disability. Well, what additional disability could we file for? If the claim is barred, there's nothing further to assert. This claim for a 24% rating, Mr. Bucara's condition has deteriorated. His knee gives way. His leg gives way. He has constant pain and weakness. This injury claim has never been rated, Your Honor, and that's the problem that we're asking this court to address.
Mr. Ciccolo, you've gotten into your rebuttal time. We can obviously save the rest for rebuttal, or you can continue.
Yes, I'm going to save the rest, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, sir. Mr. Fitzgerald.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of George Mason University. The commission properly saw this case for what it is, which is a third bite at a permanency rating. And the commission also correctly interpreted its prior decisions as it has the power to do, and its findings on that were not arbitrary and capricious.
It seems that Mr. Ciccolo is pointing at least to two, maybe several circumstances where the evaluation by Dr. Jackson was focusing on something different than Dr. Salter was focusing on, and suggests that there was some deterioration between when Dr. Salter conducted his evaluation and when Dr. Jackson ultimately did his. If that is indeed the case, why wouldn't a claimant be able to come back to the commission and have the latest circumstances addressed by the commission?
Two reasons. The most important one is that the July 2013 opinion, the very first one, made two rulings. It found that the rating was defective as a matter of law. It also found a lack of causation. That's very important. Mr. Bucara could have all the deterioration he wants. It's not going to save it from the res judicata effect of that causation opinion. Causation in workers' comp is very different than the other elements of a permanency rating. If the commission finds that you have failed to causally relate your permanency rating to the work injury, which is what happened here, then it doesn't matter if you deteriorate later, because that deterioration likewise is barred by that final finding about causation. That's the most important.
Let me make sure I understand. Is your point that if an individual suffers a compensable leg injury, that person, and a rating is established at some point, that person would be precluded from coming back to the commission if there is deterioration to that same leg? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is, and I may not have heard your question correctly, if a person has a compensable injury like Mr. Bucara and he files a claim for permanency benefits, and the commission says those benefits, that permanent impairment is not related to your work injury, that is a final ruling. You cannot come back and relitigate that causal connection, even if there is a deterioration. So in this case, even if there's a deterioration, that lack of a causal connection in the original opinion would bar any consideration of the deterioration. But in this case, there's insufficient evidence of a deterioration. The commission made specific factual findings that the two doctors rated the same static medical condition. The commission could have found that Dr. Jackson showed a deterioration, but it found instead that what really is going on is that you have two different doctors giving different ratings because they've done different evaluations.
There seems to be some disagreement between you and Mr. Ciccolo as to what the standard of review is. What do you believe the standard of review is and why?
I think it may depend on what the issue is. I think for most of this case, the standard of review is your classic, does credible evidence support the findings of the commission? And so, for example, between Dr. Salter and Dr. Jackson and the weight that the commission gave to its factual findings, I think that's a credible evidence standard. I think to the standard that applies to the commission's interpretation of its own prior decisions, I think that's an arbitrary and capricious standard. The commission is, and that comes out of that Rusty's case, where the this court held that the commission has the power to interpret its prior decision.
And what standard of review would you impose with regard to resolution of the issue of collateral estoppel and or res judicata?
I'm not sure if we addressed that in the brief now off the top of my head. I think that is, that may be de novo because it's a question of law. I think that the factual findings of the commission are binding on this court if they are supported by credible evidence. So, for example, when the commission says, our prior opinion found this, I think as long as that's supported by credible evidence, that's binding on this court. The legal effect of that, whether that actually triggers a res judicata argument, is probably a de novo, I would suspect.
Mr. Fitzgerald, I want to, if I could go back for a moment to something you said earlier. Did I hear you correctly saying that in the review opinion in 2013, the commission based its denial on two different rationales?
Correct.
And could you tell me what that second one was again? Because I'm
Yes, the second one, and it is at page 154 of the appendix. The commission found no reason to credit Dr. Salter's opinion and said that it did not reveal any loss of use. And then they said, finally, we cannot find that the claimant's testimony alone substantiates an ongoing loss of use in his left leg. It would be unusual for symptoms in his left leg to have been undocumented by medical personnel between 2009 and 2011.
And so, you read that to mean something other than the claimant didn't establish didn't carry his burden of proof on the permanent partial.
That, and farther up on the page, the first full paragraph where the commission said that had he found that they would award permanent partial disability for loss of his leg related to his back injury, which would be compensable, but that is not the evidence here. And the medical evidence, and they talk about Dr. Shuler finding pain and numbness in his leg, ongoing severe left extremity pain, but then
Are you suggesting that the opinion is holding that the injury is not related, or the pain is not related to the original injury?
That's correct. Mr. Bukira has a pre-existing impairment of his leg from, I believe it was polio when he was a child. So he has a pre-existing leg length discrepancy that predates this injury. And so in the initial opinion, one reason the commission rejected Dr. Salter's opinion was he didn't take that into account and didn't find that the impairment, the 11% that he found, was related to the work injury versus related to his pre-existing condition. So I read that as a finding on causation, that Dr. Salter's rating, regardless of whether it's defective as a matter of law, is not causally related to this work injury.
Thank you.
So I think that is a final decision, the July 2013 opinion. It's not premature, and I think the MMI issue, the maximum medical improvement issue, is crucial in distinguishing this case from the Brown versus United Airlines and the Rusty's case. Here, everything that was necessary to award permanency benefits was there accepts the sufficiency of the medical opinion and the other evidence itself, whereas the other cases, there was something missing. There was a piece left, and the commission has the power to continue a matter until maximum medical improvement is reached. That's not the case here. Brown has actually been construed as a very narrow holding, and it holds that the commission can defer if the matter is premature and unripe, and that's the reported decision of this court in Brock versus Voith-Siemens, which held
Mr. Zerf, we can get back to a point that Mr. Trickle argued. Why is it then, in this case, that the commission, through its own opinion and conclusions, left the case open if there was nothing to be resolved?
As I read what the commission said, and this is what the commission itself said that it said, it was only referencing the fact that the statute hadn't run yet. So in theory, even though there was a failure of the rating from Dr. Salter, had there been proof of a deterioration, maybe there would be a claim that could be filed. But all that is saying is that you still have not run your statute out yet. As the commission found, the commission had no intent and never said, you can file another claim and we guarantee you're going to be awarded permanency benefits.
I'm obviously not as experienced in this as you are, but is that unusual for the commission to basically state in an opinion that, by the way, your statute of limitations does not run?
No, they do that all the time, actually. Oftentimes when the commission dismisses a case, let's say, for example, a party withdraws a claim, the commission will enter an order withdrawing the claim and reminding the party that they have until such and such a time to refile if that's what they want to do. They will, it's one of those, they don't do it in all their opinions. It may depend on who's writing the opinion, but it's not that unusual that it's odd that they did it in this case.
Well, why shouldn't that language not be construed to mean the same thing as the at this time language in Rusty's? It looks to me like the commission is basically making or drawing a conclusion that this claim is still open and can be revisited.
Well, I think that prejudices employers if you were to hold it that way, because what you have here, unlike Rusty's and Brown and other cases similar to that, where the case is not ripe yet. The way the commission treats permanency benefits is the injured worker has to file a claim within a certain time, but he may not have all his evidence by the time he has to file the claim. So the commission will keep a claim open if there's no maximum medical improvement so that an injured worker doesn't lose his claim because he files it too soon or he files it too late because he doesn't have all the pieces he needs. In this case, the claimant had all the pieces he needed and chose to go forward with his claim. This would be a different claim had there been a finding of no maximum medical improvement in the first go-around. This would be a different claim if the claimant had asked the commission to defer adjudication of it until there was a finding of maximum medical improvement or something like that. But here, if you litigate all the pieces of the claim and the evidence is defective, and the claim is told, here is why your evidence is defective, and he gets to come back again and say, okay, well, now I've got another opinion. Let's see if this one works. And then that fails. Then he gets to come back again and say, well, now I have another piece of evidence. Maybe this will work. That's prejudicial to defendants, employers in cases, because and that's what this court sort of said in the Creasy case, which I know is an unreported decision, but I think is sufficiently probative here that it's instructive to the court. If you find in favor of Mr. Bukir here, you would almost implicitly have to find that that Creasy case is decided wrongly.
Well, I'm not sure that's correct, Ms. Fitzgerald. In Creasy, we held that the claimant hadn't proven that the injury was related to the work. It wasn't just MMI in that case. It was his failure to establish a compensable injury in the first instance.
Correct, but the important part about Creasy is the claimant went forward and said, I'm ready to try my case on the merits, lost, and then said, you should have kept it open so I can come back with more evidence. And that's exactly what Mr. Bukira is trying here. He went, tried the case on the merits. When he lost, he said, well, now you should have kept it open and allowed me to come back with more evidence. So I think conceptually they're identical, especially when you have the language in the first opinion that denies the claim as to causation as well.
All right, is that your argument, Mr. Fitzgerald?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Piccolo, you have about 3 minutes left.
Yes. Your Honor, yeah, the first important point on page 154, the first rating that was reversed by the full commission 2-1 was because there was no radicular symptoms in the left leg. Mr. Bukira's polio is in the right leg. That's documented on page 103 in one of the reports. But the rating was defective because there was no medical evidence of radicular symptoms in the left leg. 2 years later, there clearly are. Now,
could you address Mr. Fitzgerald's argument that there's an alternative holding in that 2013 opinion?
It's clearly not, Your Honor. I don't see what he's talking about. They're saying that the claimant's testimony standing alone is not sufficient of radicular symptoms sufficient for a permanency award in the left leg. That's all that's saying. And the ruling is defective because they say it's defective as a matter of law because the ongoing S1 distribution pain was the basis for the 11% disability, and there was no medical evidence to show a loss of use. And that's now been documented because Dr. Jackson did some additional tests to document that and to show a further deterioration. But as far as what the commission meant, what better judge of what the commission intended than what it said? In its ruling stating that our August 2013 claim was not barred, they said it was dismissed without prejudice. I'm reading from page 176 of the appendix. Without prejudice to his right to refile within the statutory period. They even say he must provide some evidence of permanent partial disability within 36 months from the last date from which compensation was last paid. We did that. And I respectfully submit the commission is not in the habit of writing published opinions telling people, you have this time to file a claim, but it's going to be barred. They're not in the business of telling people what the statute of limitations is for barred claims. If this was a barred claim, they would have said that. What this court said in Browns, and it's quoted on page 11 of our brief, nothing in the commission rules warns an employee that the deputy commissioner's removal of a case from the hearing docket has the effect of converting this ruling to a final order barring further proceedings. And if you look at page 154, it says reversed. It doesn't say final order. And then as in this court's Brown opinion, what was said there is equally applicable here. To give this procedural ruling substantive effect in the absence of a clear dismissal of the claim is arbitrary and capricious and denies Brown access to relief where the law is to be construed in her favor. So, Your Honor, the consequences of this ruling, I respectfully submit the rule of law has been sacrificed, that this is for whatever reason, it's a result-oriented opinion. I don't know why, but the holdings and intents in Brown and Rusty's weren't held. The commission didn't follow its own rulings. But I was before you last year for Ms. Blakey's case. Case went on for 3 years for a permanency award. When these rules are bent, it falls on the working people who are least able to afford it. And in my personal experience, both of the claimants have been minorities. So what I respectfully ask this court to do is to remind the commission that when it says something, it means it, and that the precedents of this court are binding. This court has
I think I wrote Blakey, and as I recall, you won in that case, and so to suggest some racial overtones regarding administration of justice, I don't think is fair.
No, sir. I'm talking about the policy, this apparent war on claimants that is going on between the Attorney General's office and the majority of the commission. This court granted relief, and Ms. Blakey, I'm pleased to report, has now been paid. But when these rules are bent, there have been rules that have been established for race judicata, for what you need for a permanency award. When those rules are bent, the consequences
I'm not sure your comments concerning the commission are appropriate, and I think you might want to move off of that very quickly.
I think
let's go ahead and sum up there for us, Mr. Chickler.
Yes. The law governing the standard here is clearly de novo, and the fundamental flaw in the commission opinion is that it doesn't dismiss the claim. And if you have a defective rating, that means that there could be one of two problems. A, you don't have a finding of maximum medical improvement, or B, you don't have sufficient evidence to support the disability rating. The second component was what was defective here. The commission didn't intend that ruling to be final, because if it did, it would have stated it. And when we did what the commission said, the commission changed the rules ex post facto. And when there's a clear Scrivener errors in Dr. Jackson's report when he erroneously refers to the fifth edition instead of the sixth edition, and the commission's reaching for that as a way of disregarding his findings, it seems to me that's not a legitimate rejection of the evidence in this case. So I would respectfully ask this court to simply follow what it did in Brown and Rusty's, and to apply what the commission said that the claimant must do. We filed within the time period and did present uncontroverted evidence of permanent partial disability. So we respectfully ask this court.
The matter is presented. We'll now move to the next case in council.